In the village, in Côte d'Or, the village, which was 1966, covered 81 communes.
That sounds right.
25 got village name recognition as well.
Yep.
So Vansobre, Rasto, Baume de Venise. So there were some whites there probably that I don't know if you caught in your number, but I think 25 is the number I got. It's somewhere between 18 and 25, I guess we could go with either.
Yeah.
You know, some of them might have a name recognition, but not specific sub-appellation contrôlée or something.
Yeah. I mean, the ones I have, and I they made sense to me because, you know, there's starting at the top, Côte Rôti, Château Grillet, Condrieu, Hermitage, Crows Hermitage, Saint-Joseph, Cornas, someone. You know, there are eight of them. I dropped one.
Yep.
And then, you know, going further south, you've got Gigondas, Saint-Péré, Baume de Venise, Vaccaras, Caran,
Rasto, Lirac.
Yeah.
Lirac would be one of them.
Anyway.
Yeah, and Sablé, you said that too. Okay, so yeah, go with the 18. You don't have to name them all, but you can throw a few out there. So people will know, like, hey, these are the... It's Côte d'Or somewhere on the label, and there's a village name for it. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. Yeah, and I didn't write a lot of those down. You might have more of those, like the Sablé and stuff.
I just had the southern ones. I didn't write any of the northern
ones.
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah, and because we've got 21 grape varieties in the south, right?
We can run. I also think we have plenty, but I think that we should say that the Rhone is a very large area. We're concentrating in the south, and there are different characteristics of the north and the south, and both. Geologic.
This is WOOL FM Radio 91.5 Bellows Falls. You're listening to What's My Wine, a conversation about wines from throughout the world. And it's just a conversation among friends who like good wine, good food, and the opportunity to learn about different parts of the world, cultures, and styles of cooking as experienced through the various styles of wine. Today, our subject is the wines of the Southern Rhone Valley. So the Rhone is this mighty river system that goes from, I believe it's Lyon, all the way down through to the Mediterranean. And when it hits the Mediterranean, it's split into two arms, creating this absolutely spectacular broad delta, which is called the Camargue. There's an extensive region of salt marshes that reach out into the Mediterranean Sea. There's flamingos that feed on the shrimp. There's oyster beds. There are wild white horses that populate that part of the world. It's extraordinary. And that's just that leading edge of the Rhone as it meets the Mediterranean Sea and creates this remarkable delta. So going from the Mediterranean farther north, that's when you hit the Southern Rhone wine region. And what I'm learning from my friends Joe Canini, Keith Zimmerman, is the extraordinary variety and the richness of the wines that are produced in this part of the world. Today we're going to be tasting five different wines, and we're beginning with a wine that's called Parallel 45, and I thought that would be a great jumping off point to talk about where we are in the world, what is the style of this wine, and why is it called Parallel 45? So, Keith, maybe you can enlighten us a little bit.
In past programs, Joe's mentioned Parallel 45 numerous times as the longitude, latitude.
I think it's latitude.
Latitude.
The sweet spot.
The sweet spot where grapes grow, you know, wine grapes grow really well, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere. And this particular winemaker is Paul Jabalayane, is his Côte d'Or and her Côte d'Or, because it's a female winemaker there. They named it Parallel 45, which is that sweet spot in the world for growing grapes. And this particular wine was the first wine that was labeled Côte d'Or. So it's got a history.
1950, I think that was the first time it was labeled Côte d'Or, which is going back a ways.
Yeah,
actually.
I think it's even older, Joe. I think maybe I think it goes back into the 1909 kind of time frame, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Way back then.
I did a little reading before we began this program, and in the mid-1700s, it was Louis XV that identified the Côte d'Or name as a territory for winemaking, and the cases had to be stamped CDR, Côte d'Or, to indicate their place of origin and thereby the quality of the wine. And that was very important to the king at that point in time, because this was a part of France that was producing the wines that were suitable for the kings, and also prior to that, suitable for the popes. And it was in actually much earlier, in the mid-1400s. Pope Clement, I think, is the one who made his summer home in Avignon. And that was the revitalization of winemaking in that part of the world, which had gone dormant after the Romans. And then all of a sudden, the popes decide to summer in Avignon. And what do they need? They need great wine to go with their amazing food. So that was also a period of identification of the wines coming from this region.
So they weren't bashful either. After after Pope Clement, the next one, I think it was Pope John the 22nd, he kind of knew a good thing. I mean, he really...
This was a good thing.
This was a good thing. And I think he put a lot of resources, church resources, into developing the vineyards and the wineries, et cetera. And they had been there for a long time, as you say. The Bishop of Avignon had
exactly,
claimed
yeah.
to them, et cetera. But,
yeah.
but I think Pope John really figured out, we could do something here. And so by the time he finished, he was ordering 3,000 liters a year for consumption at his palace to give to ambassadors and to visitors, etc. So further to the Côte d'Aron, the Château Neuf de Pape became like a very important kind of trademark of wine in the world.
Right, and actually, as long as we're talking history, that name Château Neuf de Pape, it is the new home of the Pope. That was the indicator of Avignon as being now the center, at least in the summer months, of the power of the church throughout France, certainly, and Italy. And these were the wines that followed in their wake. Isn't it interesting to just remark that in many of the areas where we've been studying different wines and their history, the winemaking follows where the power of the church establishes its seat or its reach, because winemaking required a little bit of money.
It was all about the communion wine.
Yeah, I can appreciate that would be a great selling point for the church. But meanwhile, 3,000 liters of wine for a year,
for communion. That's a lot of masses, I got to tell you.
I don't know if that's going to work, man.
Well, I think what we can all agree on, this region is historically very, very important. I think the Greeks first brought wine to these areas, but the Romans taught people how to plant vines and make it for themselves. So it was around for a long, long time. It has suffered the same sort of historical calamities that other places have suffered, wars, phylloxera, etc. But they when they rebounded with resources, and the church was a big,
yes.
big part of that.
The church is a powerhouse.
And so it's been historically very important, and it's interesting to me because it's a pretty vast area, the Rhone Valley, and it's divided pretty neatly geographically and weather conditions-wise, north and south, and we're talking about the south today, but the north equally is an amazing part, and maybe we'll have a show one. Keith would like that, I think, and short on the northern road.
I would look forward to that.
Because stylistically, the wines are quite different there.
Yes.
The grape varietals that are used are different there, but the further south
I think, you're just getting on that for a minute.
Yeah.
In the southern Rhone, approximately 21 grape varieties that are allowed to be used in their blends. In the northern Rhone, just in the red wines itself, there's only one grape. That's Syrah.
Right.
That's it. It's sort of like the Burgundy. There are no other red grapes in
the
northern Rhone. And also in the northern Rhone, there are just two white grapes, I believe. Well, three. So you've got Marzahn, Rosanne, and Viognier.
And Viognier, yeah.
That's it. And so compare that to in the southern Rhone, where you have, again, these 21 varieties, 10 reds and 10 whites, approximately. But
so I guess probably the Château Neuf de Pape would be the most recognizable name of the wines from the southern Rhone. But some of the other names that I recognize as I was reading through some of the wine descriptions, Vacquerat, for example, I didn't know that it came from southern Rhone. I know discrete labels better than I know regions.
Yeah.
So it was interesting for me to see that Gigondas, for example, and Château Neuf de Pape and Vacquerat, they're shoulder to shoulder, Château Neuf de Pape being the king, and then the second cousin being Gigondas, and then the younger brother of the second cousin would be the Vacquerat. or so, something along that line.
And
right?
Some years, those they switch places, I think, sometimes, depending on what the vintage has been like, et cetera. But, yeah, I would agree that Chateauneuf du Pape is the most well-known. And
certainly the most well-known. I mean, people could argue quality in those areas,
yes.
You know, and that's part of the tasting thing to see what you like. But as far as price point, Chateauneuf is going to bring them generally get you have to pay a bit more for those wines.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about an area that is just north of Provence. So Provence is known as this, you know, the hot, dry,
very Mediterranean.
Very Mediterranean. Climate. So you go a little bit north of there and you have the Rhone cutting this broad swath, this valley, and there are these mountains to the east, and they're called the Dentelle de Montmirail. And Dentelle means lace. So it is this laced edge of an outcropping of limestone, an upwelling of limestone that has weathered and eroded over time to create this natural buffer for the weather coming in from the north. And what's happening is this phenomenon called the Mistral. These relentless winds 300 days out of the year. And everybody's heard these mythic stories, I think, about the Mistral actually driving people, you know, out of their minds to the edge of madness because the winds are incessant. So I was reading about how these winds actually scour this valley. It is an attribute to the winemaking because the vines always dry out, and thereby it prevents any chance of rot. We were talking about wine rot in our last program, which was surprising to me. And yet here in this part of the world, seemingly these winds are beneficent because they keep the vineyards dry.
That, and I think a lot of these vineyards are characterized, all kinds of different soil types, but the best of them are often characterized by a mixture of clay and sand, and then these pebbles, these alluvial galettes, they're called, and they look like potatoes, like they're big, like baked potatoes, a little flatter, and they are alluvial stones that have been washed down from the great ice age melt, etc. And as the Rhone Valley was formed, those incredible torrents would come down, and they would roll these stones over, and they were all deposited in the southern Rhone Valley, mostly lots of them around Chateauneuf du Pape. And so it's really amazing that that combination of the intense sun, the winds that can be cooling and heating depending on the season, and then the soil, and then the soil types which retain heat. They retain heat and they drain water. And so the conditions for disease and mildew and pests are minimized by that combination.
That was a remarkably interesting aspect to the geology to me. The presence of these alluvial stones, this array of stones that is, they're apparent in different layers of the soil. And what they do is they retain the heat that they receive during the day, and they give that heat off during the night. So it keeps the vines warmer even during this longer growing season. And so I was interested to read about the fact that these vines are pruned so that they're lower to the ground, so that they are in relation to that heat that's being released from the stones that are in the soil.
And more protected by the wind.
And more protected from the wind, yeah. So we have this this first wine, Parallel 45, and I'm just curious, is this, in the cursory reading I was doing, most of the wines from this region, unlike the Syrah-based wines of Northern Rhone, these wines often are blends.
I'd say they're always a blend.
Uh-huh.
As you were talking about the climate there, it's hot. And getting a wine, you know, balance of the wine, the right acidity, the right sugar content, there's really not one grape that does that. So the winemakers are blending grapes to find a balance that's got the right sugar alcohol content as well as the acidity. There's just not one grape that they can do that with. So in the Southern Rhone, they're almost always three grapes that are in the wines, and that's Grenache, Mourvèdre, and Syrah. And then there are these other 20-something that they can blend in. But those three are the ones you almost always will see in the blend. And in California, you'll see that too. They'll call them the GSM.
GSM, Grenache.
You know, so the Rhone Rangers in California.
In Australia too. Yeah. Australia.
You know, the Rhone Rangers. Yeah. Oh, that's very good.
Yeah, they call them that. So out there. And so you'll see GSM.
These are the three grapes that are actually creating the backbone of the wine. So what are the attributes of the Syrah then, that grape? Why is that such an important, essential backbone?
I wish I could answer that question. I'm not sure. Maybe Joe can. It's, Syrah, I would think it would probably have a bit more acidity than the other two. It's smoky. I don't know. I really don't know how it grows here.
It does impart a profile, though, that when it's 100% by itself, as in the north, evokes all kinds, for me, it evokes all kinds of very unique flavor profile and aromas. Could be very floral, and it can, on the mouth, go to fruit with a great big acidic backbone with some tannins to gamey kind of aromas, flavors. It's forest floor. It's very, very complex. The ones in the south, to me, are driven by fruit first and foremost, and you're getting that from the Grenache primarily. And it's interesting that two of the three grapes you mentioned, Grenache and Mourvèdre, from an origin standpoint, both started in Spain.
Yeah.
And so the heat is just unrelenting there. So they're really good grapes when it comes to high heat conditions. The Syrah, though, to me, gives a character in these blends.
I was going to say, memories that I have of certain wines I've tasted where Mourvèdre was part of that blend, and to me, that's a deeper, earthier, muskier.
That's the power.
Grape, yeah. Is that where that comes from?
To me, that's where that comes from, power. And I've had it in a Bandol wines in Provence. Can sometimes be 100% Mourvèdre in there. Almost undrinkable young because it's such a highly tannic.
Yes, that's true.
But it's a powerful wine. And when that softens and mellows, it's just a sublime drink, really. So I think all these grapes have their role. Just like in Bordeaux, where they're blending grapes and they have specific roles. In the south of France, these blends can really vary dramatically. But you almost always find in the south a Grenache being a feature at the front.
That's so interesting.
I think it's really rare to find 100% Syrah in the south.
I've never had one.
They're there, you know, a Côte de Rhône Syrah, it's 100. Well, it'll never say that. It'll rarely say that on the label. It's just extremely rare. You'd see Grenache. And then maybe equal numbers of the Syrah and Mourvèdre.
Yeah.
In this case, we have a Carignan's added to this blend, which is also a Spanish grape.
Yeah.
Came from the hot area. It's really old grape. That one's really,
really old
grape.
Yeah.
Well, so while you take a taste of this first wine, Parallel 45, I did want to remind everyone we're listening to WOOL-FM 91.5, Bellows Falls, Vermont. This program is What's My Wine, and today it's a conversation among Joe Canini, Keith Zimmerman, and myself, Cynthia Reeves, and we're exploring the wines of the Southern Rhone region in France. It's the region just above Marseille, following the mighty Rhone River up its incredibly impressive valley, verdant valley, with a lot of limestone, a lot of alluvial stone and soil, bounded on one side by the Dentelle Mountains, and on the other side, you've got expressions of the land coming up from the Pyrenees. There's some upwellings that help create this beautiful basin. So it's very allowing for some expressions of the grape in a part of France that has become a powerhouse. So what are you thinking?
So this wine, it's mainly Grenache, 48%. The Syrah is 37%. Carignan is 10%, and Mourvèdre is 5%.
Now, Keith, earlier on you said that your orientation towards the Southern Rhone wines is totally based on this Côte de Rhône Parallel 45. It's something that's in your memory that you come back to again and again.
For me, yes,
as a baseline,
that's
true. Yes.
Yeah, it's actually made by a winemaker that's in the Northern Rhone, but a lot of these large producers and a number of these other wines we'll try today, some of them are based around Orange or in Châteauneuf, but they either own properties in other parts of the Rhone and they vinify from Cornas or Saint-Joseph, whatever. In the case of Paul Jaboulet, this is a Northern Rhone producer, but I just like the way she makes these wines. It's a wine I come back to.
Well, I can definitely taste that this would be just a wonderful wine with all manner of food. Like you could have this with charcuterie and cheeses. You could have it with stew and things with much deeper flavor.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a hunter, these wines just go great with venison or
boar.
You know, they tend to have sort of a not mushroomy, but it's sort of this
forest floor kind of taste.
Yeah. And then you have the red berries. To me, a little more blackberry than raspberry in this wine. Maybe cherry, perhaps.
Dark cherry.
Mm-hmm. Not getting the cherry as much, but I get what Syrah is bringing to the party here. And I think that's a pretty good percentage of Syrah, 30-some-odd percent.
You mean generally that's
generally
kind of high?
To me, that seems like it's kind of high, because I would always be looking at some of these things being 60% Grenache, right? And then so there's only 40% left, and there are a lot of other choices that they can put in. But being a northern-owned producer, primarily Jablayanais, I'm not surprised. And so I get, to me, this is more of a northern expression of a southern Cote d'Rhone.
To me, it is, too. I mean,
coming back to it.
I mean, we're not trying one today, but Gigal is another producer.
Oh, yes, I've seen that, yes.
A big producer in the north. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you taste his Cote d'Rhone. It's
Saint Cosme, all those things.
They have that little bit more northern size. But I'm getting off the subject here, but that's, this wine to me is just, it's organic, biodynamic, if that's of interest to people listening. They made the change to organic in 2006, so they've been growing organically since 2006.
So am I right in tasting that there is some tannin here and that it was aged perhaps in oak?
I doubt it.
No? I don't think it's aged in oak.
I don't think it is. I think it's probably getting that tannin from the stems and the skin.
Nice.
But I'm pretty sure that they are fermenting in stainless steel, maybe some large oak vats. If it's in oak barrels for aging, they would be used. They wouldn't be. Yep. They wouldn't be
new.
New.
No.
I don't taste the vanilla that you typically get in a new.
Mm-hmm.
But it's structure here.
There's definitely structure here. And I'm thinking it's probably going to open in the glass. It feels a little tight, and so maybe it's going to relax a little bit and give a little bit more of that fruit, that blackberry quality.
I mean, one of the best things about this wine is it's so widely available. The family...
Sort of a go-to.
The family did a really, really good job, I think starting around 1960, with trying to bring their wines to the first Europe and then the rest of the world.
The changes that they made, which I'm finding so interesting, is that on the label they actually list out the percentages of the grapes used, which seems to be unusual, because I think for some vintners that would be like a state secret.
Yeah.
Like you just don't tell people what you're doing, right?
I think it's great, though, if you're a winemaker, and I think she is of the school, that you're going to change the blend from year to year based on what you have.
Exactly.
And so telling
I think it's
people,
really quite amazing that she's doing that.
Yeah.
It's not typically a French thing. Maybe it's a Swiss thing.
I know, right? Because the French tend to be a little, they keep things very close to their vest.
Yeah.
And also, there's this proprietary information. I think at some point we're going to be tasting a Chateau Neuf de Pape, which is a blend of the 13 different grapes all in one go. And how that's blended for each producer is a tightly held secret.
You know, wines... especially these wines, for some reason, it's probably because my experience in France at the time I started getting interested in wine shortly after I was a student, so funds were always an issue. And so I don't know how many poulet roti dinners I've had in small little cafes in the countryside in France.
Roast chicken.
But there's a lot. Yeah, poulet roast chicken. But there's been a lot of roast chicken dinners, and typically it would just be the wine of the local thing in a pitcher. And if you were anywhere in the south of France, you're getting a Cote d'Rhone. So Cote d'Rhone and roast chicken.
Not a bad get.
it passes my, sort of test of, this would be fantastic with roast chicken and a lot of other things, too.
You know, I have to mention that it was after one of the tastings, I think the Macon, and there was one wine that we were maybe more ambivalent about. And I happened to have a little taste of it with food that I was cooking that night. And it just changed everything about the wine. And I'm thinking about that now, tasting this Cote d'Rhone, because this seems to have such a great kind of universal appeal to it. And it would just be so, it would kind of come alive I would think, if it was served with food. We do have some pate and cheeses if you're feeling desperate.
Well, I was thinking, I'm going to change gears on you just a little bit, Cynthia. This producer, Paul Jabulet, is in a town called Tain. And Tain is just a few miles from Valence. The northern Rhone is from Vienne on the north to yes. Valence on the south.
Mm-hmm.
And then the southern Rhone is below Valence. For those listening who might work at Marcom Image, Image is headquartered in Valence.
I did not know that. Yeah, that's awesome.
So our local people who work on printing little fine things on M&Ms or whatever, you know,
might know of Valence.
Might know of Valence or have been there.
And if they were there, they're lucky to have been, because it's like a great, great food town, really great food town in France.
You know, can I just venture to say that there are many, many towns in France that are great food towns?
But this is when you might drive a couple hundred miles to.
Oh, I see. Oh, that good.
Yeah, these are.
Well, there you go.
These are the rare breed. Yes, those two.
I think so.
But, well, so we have a second wine coming up, and this wine is Carène. The producer is Alain Jaume.
Alain Jaume is like me.
J-A-U-M-E, Alain Jaume.
Jaume.
And what does the title Carène?
Carène?
What does that
mean? Yeah, Carène is a cru within the Côte du Rhône. So in the Côte du Rhône, the basic thing, there's some, how many, 200 villages?
168 villages is what the one number that I saw.
Yeah, the grapes can come from those. And then there's a next level called Côte du Rhône Village. And the Côte du Rhône Village is maybe 25. You know, if you see Côte du Rhône with, you know, a name
after it,
that's a little more special, a little more specific. And then it comes to the cru. And what we're drinking here is a Côte du Rhône cru. The Châteauneuf-du-Pape is also a cru. The Lérac we have is also a cru.
Do you know if there are different characteristics in terms of what they're allowed to use, what they're allowed to blend?
I think there are some. I don't know specifically, but Tavel, for example, you know, it's almost 100% rosé.
Right. Very good.
That's made in that particular area. So I'm guessing that there are some specifics that they have to do, but I don't know.
It is often true that if you move from a Côte du Rhône to a Côte du Rhône name village, and certainly to a cru, the quality tends to follow that. And I think it's mostly because in the Côte du Rhône, Appellation, you can blend from anywhere, and it's quite a large area. And the grapes can come from anywhere, but when you're in a smaller situation, they know exactly where the grapes are coming from, and they're using them for a particular blend or whatever. It's not going in necessarily to a giant regional cooperative where it's blended up. It's being made on site. So the quality is...
Again, you know, we've used this term cru, which means growth, if there's literal translation. But I'm wondering if you can just say again, what does that mean in terms of winemaking, like Grand Cru?
Burgundy, the Grand Cru would be by vineyard site. My understanding of these cru sites, it's of village.
Yeah.
Like, that's where
excellent.
The wine comes
excellent.
From.
Yes.
So it's a little different.
So that's a great clarification, actually.
Bigger.
Yeah, because, you know, there's all of this terminology, which can be a little intimidating if you don't know your way around the wine label.
And it's not necessarily consistent.
I know, that's what I'm seeing.
Right,
yeah.
I mean, Grand Cru versus Premier Cru in some areas.
Right.
Premier Cru is the top.
Yeah.
In another area, Grand Cru is the top.
Yeah. and sometimes it really is quality, and sometimes it's family split up or politics or something where things have been designated a certain way.
So have you tasted this Jaume?
Quality wise, for me, it is a step up from the Parallel 45. Just in that I feel like
I feel like
the floral and the fruit characteristics are kind of leading the way here.
Oh, absolutely!
Red fruit
right up front. Mm.
And so I think that's, I don't know what the blend on this is, but it's probably the Grenache.
It's sort of a white plum quality to it. It's really luscious. It's lovely.
It's very good. It would be great with food, but it stands alone. You know, it's very pleasant on its own.
Well, I would be much happier to drink a glass of this on its own than the Parallel 45.
Agreed, yeah.
I think the Parallel 45 is just sort of begging for food to make it come alive.
The acidity is a bit higher, and yes. This one's a little rounder.
Yes.
To me, it's really, this one to me is more Southern Rhone.
Agreed, yeah.
And then the Northern, then the Parallel 45.
You want to assume that there's a softness to the wine, but that's not the case. It really has a beautiful, round quality to it.
This is lovely. It's a 2022 vintage. It's not been in the bottle very long. And these wines, I would think, could easily go comfortably 10 years.
Now, is that also based on the fact, like, we always talk about the alcohol content, and the alcohol content in these tends to be a little higher. Does that have any direct correlation to how long it could be in the bottle?
I mean, all of those things have, to me, it's the acidity, tannin, and alcohol. So there's sort of three things.
Structural components.
Structural
components, not just one. If it was just alcohol, it'd be,
It could be flabby and not interesting 5 years after it was put in the bottle. If it was too much, it was out of balance.
Balance. Is there enough fruit there? Is there enough tannin there to make it hang up? This is not a tannic-y wine.
No.
This one isn't.
No, it's pretty
soft.
At all.
And that's attractive. And it should be said in France, where all these wines are made, most people drink their wines like immediately. They don't cellar them for long periods of time. These would be meant, I would say maybe the Chateauneuf du Pape, yes, they could and they would, but especially if it was a designation on the label that sort of said longue garde, which means don't open this for a while.
Right.
But all wines so far that we've had, and I think they're for immediate consumption. So that's what's really attractive about this one. To me, it's ready right now.
Yes, it's young pleasurable. And luscious. Very, very
Parallel
round
40, that was,
quality.
All these were great years. I mean, there's not been a bad year in the Rhone since, everything from 2015 on anyway.
And that was the flooding, I think, mostly. But it's really hard to miss out on getting grapes ripe.
In the Southern Rhone, it's peach groves, and there's lavender, and there's rosemary, apricots. There's all of these beautiful herbaceous scents that are in the air, and it's a very different agricultural surround among all these vineyards, as opposed to in the north, which is a very different
Mediterranean versus continental climate.
Exactly, exactly. And it's like a switch from that, is it Valence where it's?
Valence is that dividing line.
Yep.
And all of a sudden the architecture and everything is totally southern.
Yes, it's so beautiful.
You know, I think, and a Cote means hillside. When I envision the south, I don't see high mountains I see a little more rolling.
With the exception of those Donti these big crop.
And I think like this one, like the Caron, from what I understand is that those Mistral, those winds, kind of these areas where they've, assigned them crew, it's protected somehow
from the Mistral.
Or they're higher.
Oh, I see.
The towns are, or the areas are.
Isn't it interesting to note that these are the fine distinctions that actually can make the entire difference between a wine that is fabulous and a wine that is not as fabulous? You know, just a few hundred meters of elevation, or whether it's south or east facing slope, et cetera, there are these nuances that come down to fine, fine details, and it makes all the difference in the taste of the wine.
People figure it out.
And
they actually figure it out, because that's why these are all crus, because they've been the best wines in the area for a long time.
Yeah, right? thank you for making that connection. Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah. We're going to go on to taste the third wine in our flight, but I do want to remind you, you're listening to WOOL FM 91.5. What's My Wine is a program, a conversation among friends about good food, good wine. And today we're tasting the wines of the Southern Rhone. The conversation is between or among Keith Zimmerman, Joe Canini, and myself, Cynthia Reeves. We've tasted one wine, a Parallel 45, a second wine, which is a Caron from a producer, Alain Jaume, and then this third wine that we're getting into. Keith, do you want to talk a little bit about this wine?
It's produced by Cellier de Chartreux. It's called Domaine Les Colombettes. It's from the specific cru, which is Lérac. And Lérac is right across the Rhone River from Chateauneuf du Pape. So if the river wasn't in the way, these would be contiguous vineyards. The Chateauneuf is on the east side of the Rhone,
Yes, Chateauneuf-du-Pape is on the east side.
And the Lirac is on the west side of the Rhône.
And it does seem that the finer producers, or the, let me rephrase, the more well-known producer, Chateauneuf-du-Pape, Gigondas, I think also,
It's a little north of...
But on the east side of the Rhône.
Gigondas is on the east side of the Rhône, about 20 miles north of Chateauneuf. The soils of Lirac and Chateauneuf are almost the same. It has the same, what are the stones called, Joe?
The galette.
It has the galette, the same ice age.
I love those descriptions.
The same ice age soil conditions. It's just the river cuts them in two. Otherwise, it's essentially the same. It just doesn't have the name recognition, at least in America, of Chateauneuf-du-Pape.
I'm so glad that you said that, because this is the first time that I've been aware of the name Lirac, and maybe the first time I've tasted a wine from Lirac. So this is definitely, it's an education. Partly it's an education about wine, but as we always say, it's an education about sense of place, of region, of culture, how culture, food, and wine all come together. So thank you for bringing this.
I was reading something about Lirac, which I thought this read up pretty well, actually, because they make rosés and whites here, too. And apparently, I've never had a white or a rosé Lirac, but apparently they're very special. But the reds are typical of the region, powerful, generous, and well-balanced, but still underestimated. And I think that aptly puts this wine. I think it hasn't benefited from the name recognition of Chateauneuf-du-Pape. It's quite a lovely wine. It's different than the Jaume.
It's very different.
The Jaume was more Grenache dominant. I don't know what the blend on this is.
It's 50-50 Grenache 50-50 Syrah.
See, the Syrah, again, is a big component of it, and I get that in this wine, because I feel like the structure is wonderful, although the tannins for me are apparent, and the ones in the Jaume were balanced really nicely by that fruit attack at the front. I think this would fall into the category of a wine that I'd want to think about for a while, just sip and think about and change. Maybe tomorrow it would be very different. It's quite good now. Like the description said, easily underestimated.
In the research that I had, it says the Cru's best red wines are notable for their perfume, their complexity, but also, and I love this adjective, their savoriness. And there it is. It's in the glass. There's a savory, savory quality, which is very, very different than the wine that we just tasted, the Jaume.
Right.
Yes?
As you go further north, this kind of savoriness becomes prominent, right? It becomes one of the big features of the wines.
So we did include in the lineup today Chateauneuf-du-Pape, because how could we go to the Southern Rhone region and not have the king of the wines? And again, the Chateauneuf-du-Pape literally is a translation of the new home of the Pope. And so this was a name that arose around the mid-1400s. It was Pope Clement who had come north from Rome and was making his summer home in Avignon, and was so taken by the quality of the wine, he wanted to put, I guess it was later on, the king wanting to put the Côte du Rhône CDR stamp on every case that got traded, because the quality and the caliber of this wine was unique, and it was a recognized attribute of France. So the Chateauneuf-du-Pape, did you bring this?
I brought this one. It's a Domaine de Christia, 2016. The family here is in Courthaison, which is to the northeast of the village of Chateauneuf-du-Pape. It's one of the villages, Courthaison, that is allowed to make wines and give them the Chateauneuf-du-Pape name. And they do, it's a really beautiful place. They do lots of tourism stays. They do, there's a restaurant there, etc. But the wine itself is 19 hectares under vine. So I don't know, what is that, Keith? 30 some odd acres? It's kind of in the northeast district. So don't know what the blend is. I haven't tasted this one in a while. But 2016 was a fantastic, really great vintage.
Now, would you cellar this for a while? Is this a wine that you could have some age on it ultimately?
In general, Chateauneuf-du-Pape is something you would save, and it can be 30 years worthy of saving.
Yes,
but again, they can be 13 different grape varietals, but they're not specified as to percentages. Closely held secret.
Yes. So actually,
and it probably varies year to year. That two Cynthia, it's not, you know, it's what they have, what they planted, right? But it's also what did happen that year, you know, with the particular varieties. What's, because those blends are going to change. That's, in my opinion, where the winemaker's art really comes into play. You know, if it's in barrels, they're going to be tasting those barrels. They're going to be deciding this one goes into our finest wine. This one doesn't make the cut. You know, winemakers are, can be a generous bunch in my experience, and, you know, talk shop and
Oregon, talk, Washington, talk, that happens talk, all the time. Things,
yeah. But, nice.
Yeah. But they'd also, they're also competing.
Well, I came across this description of the bottling of Chateau Neuf de Pape. There's one distinguished vintner. His name is César Perrin. He describes his family's Chateau Neuf de Pape Rouge, the red, as a, quote, symphony, with each of the 13 grape varieties playing a valuable role. Another vintner says, each year, each member of our family makes their own blend using all 13 varieties, and then we decide which direction to go. Blending is the key to the complexity of each vintage. So I loved that, that every family member was in it to win it. They were blending, making their own blend, using, you know, different percentages of each of these 13 varieties of grapes, and coming out with like the perfect elixir, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I envision that, I can see them with, you know, some beakers, so not big blending volumes. Right. They're blending, you know, they've got
a small flask. Quantities.
It's a science project, for sure.
I know, and that means that it would change. It could change possibly dramatically each year.
Stylistically, in that blending room, they're going to try to come up with something that the public that buys their wine is going to expect.
I agree, Joe.
This is a more traditionally focused Chateau Neuf de Pape. As I said, it was a great year, like one of the two or three really best ones in the last 30 or 40 years from what I was reading. So everything was ripe. So it was a perfect palate to approach this thing. And I would think in a big year like this, a great year like this, they wanted to try to structure this wine so it was for the long haul.
And so is that what you're tasting in the glass as well? I mean, is that structure coming through?
Yeah, I think there's a structural component. I think this wine is still pretty closed to me. I don't think it's really open.
I was wondering about that.
Just contrasting it to, like, our second wine, which was so beautifully fruit forward and everything,
it's very right seductive. There. Yes, it's right
but
there.
But this one is a little bit more.
Yes, it's going to take a little while to relax.
A little more reserved, but I think the balance is really quite nice.
Mm-hmm,
Keith,
mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I mean, I just smell the skin and stems in this wine, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean that's young. It's what it means that this wine, to me, when I smell those smells, which is what you smell right when you're making the wine in the first place, it's like this, those still haven't integrated completely in this wine. Yeah. So I think it's going to get, I think a few more
bottles,
it's going to get better.
When you think about making wine, you think about utilizing the grape. And in the last couple of discussions, we've talked about how the stem and the skin of the grape is also integrated. Those flavor profiles are actually right there.
So it's not like you want a lot of stems in the grape. The winemaker I worked for would sometimes add some stem back in. You know, we would de-stem.
Oh, that's
all
so
grapes.
Interesting.
And
what a
feel
nuance.
Like it wasn't, the tannic structure wasn't enough.
It wasn't
that's amazing.
It was quite what he wanted. You know, I never had the sensitivity to understand why he was doing that. But
am I remembering correctly when we were talking about the Willamette Valley wines? Aren't there some wines where the stems and skin had been part of the winemaking?
Yeah, whole cluster fermentation. They just call it a whole cluster.
That's
so that's
what it
a
was.
Whole
Thank
cluster
you.
Thing.
Yeah,
yeah. So they're using stem skins.
Yeah. And wasn't that Willamette?
There's a lot of whole berry crushing.
It's lending such structure, you know, throughout the entire profile of the wine as you taste it.
And, you know, I think to your point, they're doing that to get more structure, because what they don't generally have an issue with their Pinot Noir is getting those primary fruit flavors.
Yes, because that's right forward.
The cherry cola right. thing. So they figured out how to like produce something that's really kind of has the glycerin, has all that. But that structure is what's going to stand the test of time with the wine.
Do you know, Joe, does this wine spend a lot of time in barrels? Do you know what the aging time in barrels is?
I don't actually.
Because it would be in barrels, yes.
I don't know. I mean, I don't taste new barrels in this. You know,
I don't. I think it's Foudre, if anything, like these big old barrels.
Yeah, that's what it.
Because there's no vanilla in this or anything like that. I don't. As I taste, it'd be interesting this last one. But as I go through like my memory bank on tasting, and I've tasted a lot of Chateau Neuf du Pape and Cote de Rhone's, it's not that often that I get this vanilla. I'll get the primary glycerin thing from Grenache, but not the vanilla like you would get in a California
or Bordeaux
or right, Bordeaux, yeah, whatever, yeah, where that new wood is being used. And the tradition always has been large, what they call foudre, which are 200 hectoliters. So that's giant barrels. Kind of get cleaned every year, but not, what are you going to do after a while?
You steam them and put a sulfur candle into them and you do the best you can.
Do the best you can. Right. And try to make sure that there's no like bacteria. But at the same time, there's not a lot of new wood being contacted with that wine.
Exactly. Yeah. There's some evaporation. There's a little bit of oxidation going on. But it's not extracting the flavor from the wood.
So we have only one more wine in our flight of five from the Southern Rhone. You're listening to WOOL FM 91.5, a wonderful radio station out of Bellows Falls, Vermont. We're here in Walpole, New Hampshire, having a conversation about wine among a few friends, Keith Zimmerman, Joe Canini, myself, Cynthia Reeves, and we're looking at the wines of the Southern Rhone region in this hour. So we've looked at a flight of wines from Parallel 45 all the way up to the king of the Southern Rhone wines, which is Chateau Neuf du Pape. Now, even though I'm the person who provided this last bottle, I'm wondering, Joe, if you can describe what you know about this particular vintner and why this particular wine was selected to be at the end of this entire flight of tastings.
Interesting person. The name of the vintner is Javier Vignon. Javier Vignon, his family were from a different area in France altogether, and they were all stonemasons. But he broke from the family and went to school and to get an oenology degree. So having graduated from school, he started working in wineries, got the bug 100%, and started traveling all over the world to different wineries. And you know,
like
he went to South
did,
America,
Keith.
Like Keith did.
I didn't do that.
That would have been nice.
That would have been fun, but I did not. Took a different path.
Nice things do.
I think he got a lot of experience, and I think that experience where he traveled all over the world, different regions, different grapes, like wild places, I think really gave him the palette that he wanted to paint from, and he came to the Southern Rhone and found a home.
And he's usually a consulting enologist.
I don't know if he
owns any property at all.
But he gets access to grapes from the clients that he has.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
he gets access.
That's interesting.
How he makes his wines, and so he is like
he's a renegade.
He's like a micro négociant almost, like because it's his own fruit.
Yeah.
That he's making the wines, and he makes a fair number of wines, but his real calling is blending. And so
I think you called him earlier on an alchemist.
Yeah, he's kind of an alchemist. And so this wine is it's called Cuvée Anonyme.
The anonymous.
Yeah, the anonymous cuvée, because he had access to really old vine grapes. And the further back you go in time in the Southern Rhone, the more likely you are to find a vineyard that has 13 or 20 different grape varietals planted all together. And that's what he has here. It's called Cuvée Anonyme because he's not precisely sure
what
those grapes are, what's in it, but he harvested them all and then vinified them all together, not separately, because you don't know necessarily
which
one is
the
more better.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you probably would, but I think his point was, let's do this all together and see what we come up with.
You know, apropos of that, I think earlier on you were saying, maybe it was you, Keith, mentioning, in the Chateau Neuf du Pape, perhaps, the Syrah grapes are aged differently and perhaps longer because of the degree of
Well, in the Parallel 45, I know that it was, in that wine, they kept it separate and they vinified the other three together.
So that's a level of precision and control that you're giving up in this last wine that we're tasting, the Cuvée Anonyme. Correct. There is no control.
Right. In California, you can buy wines that are just called a field blend. Right. We have, there are some old vineyards out there.
Interesting, yeah.
That, which can be great.
Yeah. That's just been, you know, planted with many things and don't really know what they are. Usually there's some Zinfandel in them.
So Zinfandel, Mourvèdre, like some of these old vines.
It could be some Carignan
for a long time. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
But you know, so it's kind of a similar thing, except this is it's a 2009.
So this has ample like bottle age. So this is what the wine is. It possibly
this is doing some
wonderful things.
This is doing some wonderful things.
Yes, I mean, I think it's opposed to the 2016 that we tasted prior to this. I don't think that's quite maybe ready for prime time. I think it will be great.
I agree.
But I think, and oftentimes these wines, cru wines, I would think in the Southern Rhone and in the North too, go through this funny thing that people who taste a lot of wines will call, oh, well, that's at the bottom of the J curve or whatever. And if you think about a curve that starts and then goes, is very, very high and then goes down for a few years and then starts to go up, that's the kind of profile that
good
these wines take a lot. And so oftentimes, if, like when I was buying wine for the inn, I would buy with those things in mind. So I might put something on the list that's going to be very pleasurable right out of the gate because it's like fruit is going to be great. But then it might go kind of dormant for a few years, take it off the list, put it down in the cellar again, and then bring it back. The best expressions of these wines that go into bottle, it takes some patience, you know, I think. And so I think what we're getting here is your patience. This is really nice.
This is
good.
It's super good, isn't it?
There's nothing that jumps out of the glass to say, oh, like we were talking about earlier, the Syrah's dominating.
Exactly, here or here's
no,
the Mourvèdre.
This is a very interesting integrated wine.
Yes, yeah.
It's got the red and black fruits going on, the berries, raspberry. Originally I was smelling a little cinnamon in the background.
Spiciness, yeah.
Spicy.
There is nice spice, and it's at the
tannins,
very back
soft
of
tannins, very soft tannins.
The acid
no drying.
I love the direction that the tasting went from the Parallel 45 up to this bottle. I think it was a great decision to put this one at the end because it is an amalgamation of all of these grapes without any clear path to understand the percentages of each grape, how it's, you know, being expressed in this wine. So then I'm curious, going back, I was just trying to go back to the Chateau Neuf de Pape and taste that again. It's opening a little bit in the glass, but I agree with you, Joe. It probably would benefit from another few years, maybe, in the cellar. But it's interesting to try these two side by side. And what at second tasting, where are you with the Chateau Neuf de Pape?
It's getting better.
Yeah, I think it's loosening up.
But I don't
up.
Think
yeah.
it doesn't really compare well, I don't think, to the Cuvée Anonyme. And that just could be bottle age.
I think
and
you're
this
right.
will get yeah. better for mm-hmm. sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the Cuvée Anonyme is going to get a lot better, but I think it's going to hang out here for a while. I don't think it's in any danger of like falling off.
No. It's still right. It's very
still
present,
pretty
isn't
present.
It?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. And the surprise for me was the Jaume. You know, on the other end of the spectrum, what jumps out.
Yeah, what
the
jumps
fruit,
out
the fruit,
is
the fruit
is
jumped
the
out of there. Yeah. The Grenache jumped out of the bottle there for me, and and so that caught my attention. The Parallel 45 was closer to the Les Colombettes. The Colombette had more going on because it is a Lirac or whatever place, but the Syrah at 50%, it did something for me there that always gets my attention. But I would say the two Chateau Neufs are a really great balance of that approach. Is it fruit forward? Is it not fruit forward? It's kind of on the first one's on the way, and the second one certainly is there in terms of
totally there. And I would say that the second wine, the Jaume wine, the adjective that comes to mind is generous. It's just all right there, and it's just ready to you know give forth all these wonderful flavors and nuanced flavors of the fruit.
I will say, when I picked up the Jaume, I was in the wine shop down in Massachusetts. I was about to pick up another wine, and I explained what I was trying to do, and the shopkeeper said, I would suggest you take this wine.
Oh, good for,
you take him or her. You take the Jaume, the Caron. Yeah. There are other Jaumes there. I mean, there were three.
Oh, I see.
There were three Jaumes.
Uh-huh.
But he said, I think this one...
it's going to be the most approachable. He was thinking most approachable. Yeah.
So that's very good. And so, you know,
coming back to, you know, finding a good wine shop, people that you trust is really a good thing.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, you know, one of our intentions as we started this show, What's My Wine, was to talk about wines certainly from different parts of the world, lesser known wines, and thereby wines that are a great value. They're more cost effective than notably the Chateau Neuf du Pape's of the world. So the Parallel 45 and the Jaume, could they be said to be in a more cost competitive range? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And
the Lyrac too. I mean,
the Lyrac too.
Lyrac, because it's lesser known.
For me, this Lyrac, that's not my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, could have done more.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little flabby to me.
But maybe it's going to give up more. Maybe tomorrow.
Maybe it continues.
It's my last bottle, you know? And that's fine with me. I mean, I like Lyrac, and I've had others that I really enjoyed more.
Yes, yes.
But this particular one,
Yes, but
it's a decent wine.
Sure.
But of the ones we've had, what I'm looking at in front of me, and let me just say, it's not Lyrac the area, because Lyrac the area can produce some wonderful wines.
Yeah, beautiful.
Very floral, very beautiful.
I mean, equal to the Chateau Neuf we're drinking. Yes. It's just this particular wine, which is Cellier de Chartreux called Domaine Les Colombes, to me, the Domaine Les Colombes, which is 2018, is not knocking my socks off.
But I have to say, I just went back to take another taste.
It's plummy.
Of that. It's so plummy.
It's really plummy. It's that really...
that white plum, beautiful, you know, and it has some great integrity to it. So
tomorrow.
I think tomorrow, and with something like really deep and unctuous to eat, you know, and you're going to be in seventh heaven.
You're going to get a decent experience with any Côte de Rhône. Some will be better than others.
I'll
come back to the Lyrac now and jump in again, because the spiciness in this one also is really coming through. Maybe a little licorice too.
Exactly. There's a little pepper.
Okay, so maybe I spoke
too
soon.
At the back. Yeah. See, it's and maybe it's just like really worth making the point that even in the glass, there are remarkable changes that can take place in the attitude of the wine, in what it's able to express, in which flavors come forward, which are more assertive at the beginning, and then those same flavors may soften and other flavors begin to emerge.
Yeah, and I did read, Cynthia, that all of these, maybe not the Parallel 45, but all of the other wines would have benefited from decanting. So...
well, bad on us.
Yeah.
I know Joe is
good about decanting. I'm usually too lazy. I just pour it at a higher level and splash in the glass. But, you know, it's another thing to clean, you know. So.
Right.
But
I think you're right. I think certainly the 16 Chateau Neuf du Pape would have benefited from that.
I really think this one
I think have. The Colombette, the third, the Lyrac would have benefited from that. I think the Jaume was fine just the way
Jaume
it was.
Jaume is good.
And the last one was fine just the way it was. If you decanted it, it would probably be a little bit better, an hour richer.
Well, I can't thank you enough for this discussion. For me, this has been a real introduction to understanding my approach has been these wines in isolation and not understanding the region that they come from and how they're different expressions of this same part of France. So just to recap, we went from Parallel 45 to a wine by Alain Jaume called Carène. Then we went to, which all of us happen to really like, Les Colombettes, which is a wine from Lyrac, which is just across the Rhone River from the Chateau Neuf du Pape estates. Our fourth wine, Chateau Neuf du Pape Christia. And then this last wine, the surprising Cuvée Anonyme, which is a blend of all of the wine, all of the grapes from that region.
From Javier Vignon, who's a producer there.
Say it again, the name.
Javier Vignon.
Vignon.
V-I-G-N-O-N.
Appropriate name.
Yeah, Vignon.
Javier Vignon. So my thanks to Keith Zimmerman, Joe Canini. This is Cynthia Reeves. You've been listening to What's My Wine? The subject of this hour has been wines from the Southern Rhone region of France. And this is WOOL-FM 91.5 radio out of Bellows Falls, Vermont.
Okay, my darlings. So just be aware, I will be snipping out all of that misinformation about the mountains of the Pyrenees going in from the eastern side, western side of the Rhone, and the blah, blah, blah.
The Rhone does dump out there, I mean, so you got to cover.
No, but I said something about, because I was thinking, well, the Dentelles are on this side, and we're on that side. It's like, whoa. No, it was just, so I'll make sure that goes away.
The Languedoc would be very happy that you were on the way to mentioning them, too, so that's good.
Well, we're going to have to do a whole show on the Languedoc, my darling.
I mean, I think we can correct ourselves, you know. I mean, if we make a mistake in one of the things, we can just say.
Sure, you got to go back, and you got to say, hey, you know what, this is. But this is so interesting, and I have to say, man, I love this. I just love this. This is like...
That was the winter
wine. Isn't
that good?
How much is that a bottle?
That's a winter wine for me.
17?
Really? Oh, my God. Oh, boy, get a case, man.
I think that's what I paid.
Where'd you find it?
A Table and Vine?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Well, I'm going
to... And I was talking to Michael there. I was talking to Michael. I like Michael.
He's the bald guy?
He's the head dude.
What does he look like, though? Because I talked to everybody, whoever's around. Anytime someone says he's at home, I'm like, hey, yeah,
he's not bald. I've just known him for years. I don't know. Yeah.
They're amazing. Yes, what that store is really.
So they do a good job, don't they?
And Julian it's Michael and Julian who I like the best.
Yeah,
he's from near Larry's place in Autun, the French guy there. So he turned me on to this little Syrah, which is basically on the outskirts of Saint-Joseph for like $9 a bottle.
And yeah.
You gotta be kidding. Yeah. It's going, okay.
At Table and Vine?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
I said, okay then. You know, he says, you know, don't overlook this, you know, because...
Yeah, right.
It's going... Okay.
the 16 is definitely getting better.
But
it's opening.
But you know, I'm sorry. You know, I get into those heady discussions about like winemaking.
I don't. And think so. I apologize. Why, I want to hear that.
Me too. Me too. Absolutely. Because it's brilliant. I mean, it's so good to have them.
Can you smell that? That is the smell of those early stages of fermentation when it's just stems and skin.
We're all doing the apple pressing and we stick it's so volatile.
Yeah,
those volatile phenols or whatever they're called.
Volatile phenols. We haven't yet talked about volatile phenols, and
we better not go there.
We're not going to go there because we'd be really.
No one knows really what they mean. Bullshitting.
Would you like a little something to have with these last little bits of wine? No. Would you like more anonym in your glass?
There's the anonym. No, I don't need the anonym.
I like the aroma of the Lirac. Okay. I mean, it's licorice to me now. In this coming out, the plum. Licorice. I just don't like the mouthfeel. Maybe I should have spit it that way.
50%. 50% Syrah. This should be right up your alley.
Mm.
Keith, here's a little.
I just do not like the. I just don't like the mouthfeel. It's kind of
burning. The parallel 45 is really tough for me.
It's kind of burning.
Yeah, it's a little tough. Mm. Yeah.
Tough.
Yeah. No, the parallel 45. I thought it was going to be smoother.
Yeah.
And a little bit more forgiving. And it just, but I'm going back to it thinking, well, maybe if it's had some time to know that it's being loved.
I think you're right.
Glass.
I mean, it's just a food wine. If you put that up with a, you don't think about, this isn't a wine. The Parallel 45 is not one of those wines that.
Have a taste of the Parallel 45 with a taste
pate.
Of the pâté.
It's
and all of a sudden, the world is a much better place. You
it's
know,
perfectly
so
fine,
there you
yeah.
are.
It's got the acidity; it cuts through that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't think a parallel. I mean, I want to ponder this wine, Le Xavier.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's
when
a ponder.
When I first smelled that, I was going. Like, you know, to me, I was when I first smelled it, I was going, "This is Northern Rhone."
Oh, really?
When I first smelled it.
And why? Why?
Because,
why? Because.
Let me see if I can explain it.
Yeah, I'd be interested to.
Because I can smell Syrah in there.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I think that's what it is.
So the Syrah is sort of the trigger for you. You know that grape. You know
it's triggering, but you know at 50% Syrah, the Lirac now is it's more integrated for me than it was when I tasted it after. And I think it was a progression thing too. Going from this to this was kind of jarring. And I wouldn't necessarily change
it. Parallel.
Going from the Jaume.
Oh, to the Lirac.
To the Lirac was a little bit jarring for my palate.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I haven't gone back to the Jaume, when I've gone back to this now, actually, and I've had a piece of cheese in between.
Yeah.
Quite good.
Yeah, no. I mean,
back to the
food actually.
Yeah, quite good.
Okay, well, so maybe I need to do that.
Yeah, you need to.
And I just don't want to. Excuse my reach. I just don't want to drink it alone.
Well, you're with us.
Don't drink
it with us. You're
drinking it alone.
Boo.
I can't handle it.
Okay, keep getting it over
there. So sad.
Yeah, I
no,
mean,
it
to
isn't.
Me,
no, that tastes good.
It's
the
really
parallel,
nice,
right?
Actually. No,
I'm having the Lirac with
the
cheese now.
Oh, yeah.
The Lirac went from I'm going to sip this and try to figure it out, to cheese, like, gulp, yum,
yeah.
Yum.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That works
mm-hmm.
for me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like it so much.
See, it's so simple. Wine and food.
It is. It's
voila.
It's a food group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That tastes better now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it was. It's like almost too alcohol-y to me.
Yes.
You know,
at
by
first,
alone.
Yes, by itself.
It just wasn't.
I mean, I like the aroma, but
it
it's
felt
hot.
Like it felt hot. That's a great way. And we haven't really used
hot.
That kind of descriptor before, but I think
hot?
It's a perfectly apt one to use.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Hot. It's like a volatile, like.
Yeah, sorry.
There's more volatility than fruit, you know, that kind of thing. It's like this.
Oh.
It's keeping me from the fruit because
all I get
is this volatile
great,
thing. It's
that's
like,
a great adjective.
Is this gasoline or is this wine?
Mm-hmm.
Getting
hot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But 14.5. I mean,
They all are.
Just say.
But Jaume's doesn't have that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But 14.5 with Syrah
is high.
High.
That's high.
High.
Really?
13 is like,
13
the further north you go.
I would think that for a Syrah, that would be in the zone. So what am I missing?
Northern.
Usually 12 and a half,
yeah.
3,
come on,
13.
Really?
Late ripening, one of the later ripening varietals. And so 12 and a half is probably the middle of the fairway for that wine.
And a wine that
can't hang longer.
And a wine that can age for 30 years.
Right.
You shouldn't touch it for 10.
They have that structure behind it between with the tannins and everything, which will protect it, and the acidity, which will protect it from deterioration, really. So I think it's Syrah is a recipe for longevity, like La Chapelle, whatever. But sometimes you get Syrah that is also fruit laden, if you can get it ripe, and that's the
See,
beauty
that,
of that
that's
site.
What I always...
If you look at that site in La Chapelle, it's like southwest, like facing,
and it's like
it's
this.
Just like this, and it's all sand and gravel,
and
so it's just
steep.
Like a heat,
it's steep.
A heat seeker.
Mm-hmm.
It's really steep.
But see, I always thought Shiraz was very like heavy fruit forward.
Well, when you get
well,
to
Syrah
Australia,
is like Australia. It is.
Well, it's a clonal variety.
It's almost
it's
like
the same, but it's the same origin.
It can
but it's
be
clonal
it
variety.
Can be stomach ache wine. To me,
you're
I mean,
right.
That,
it can
that,
be because
that's
it's
really,
so,
that really
it's so
syrupy.
They go
yeah.
they
oh,
go
man.
For a different thing there.
But just what a way to kill a wine.
But Australia,
as
it's
I'm
like you're not.
You know?
There's no place in Australia that I mean. I guess you could go up in the hills of Margaret River or something like that, and get elevation enough. To get that diurnal change in temperature.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so freaking hot there all the time. I don't understand how. And that's why most of their wines are just like fruit bombs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unpleasant.
And you can produce a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm. So I mean, we could do Australia wine at one point and we could come up with a really nice
I'm sure we
tasting,
some,
but.
Yeah. The Chateau Neuf du Pape with a little bit of cheese is actually quite a wonderful thing.
Christophe.
Not softening anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You should have decanted. I should have decanted that one.
I thought about it. I mean, I thought about all these wines, and I knew we should, but then I said, you know, let's keep it the same.
We're going to
pull the cork. We're going to let them go.
Right,
and see.
Right.
They're all about the same temperature, which was
that was good.
I think the temperature was all right in there. They weren't too warm. They were nice to me.
Mm-hmm.
Good temps.
Mm.
So here's a...
Oh, yeah, we didn't talk about the color.
Yeah, we didn't, but...
Oh, yeah.
That's a little... What is that? It's going to be some kind of...
It's almost like tartrates.
Right, tartrates.
Tartrates. Hmm.
Well,
you know how you've had the experience of being someplace, you know, different country, different wine, different food, and the wine experience you have there is just so extraordinary, and you bring a bottle home and it's like, oh, what happened?
Something happened, I don't know.
But I have to tell you, I just opened a wine from around Perpignan, which I brought back from a trip with a family vacation there. And I opened it the other night, and man, it was all right there. It was all right there in the bottle. All of the flavors and aromas and experiences and the food memories, and it was a booyah moment. It was so great.
It brings you right back, doesn't it?
Oh, it does.
It's amazing.
It
has the ability to transport us to
definitely does,
an
yeah.
experience that we've had, yeah. and it's like Kodachrome.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. It's a 3D recollection. Mm. Yeah, I love that part.